Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and other musicians, uncover their life stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, then stick around. You're in the right place. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar. And I have just not only a great guitar player, but just one of the nicest guys I've had the pleasure to talk to. We're with Dave Amato from REO Speedwagon. And I'm not the only guy who likes Dave. I mean, he's so popular. I've had like five or six other guys tell me that, you know, oh, you're going to love Dave. He's a great guy. And we've had an opportunity to spend a lot of time talking over the last few weeks before the call. He's just honestly one of the nicest guys I've spoken to. Dave's one thing.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome. One thing that, you know, he's so nice. I'll excuse him for this, that he's from Boston and he's a Red Sox fan. And I grew up near Yankee Stadium.
That's right. Wow. First place too. I might add right now, big time.
Hush. Started playing guitar in 1961, but once the Beatles appeared on Ed Sullivan in 1964, that became something that took over his life. In 1980, he moved out to LA, did a short stint with Black Oak, Arkansas, played sessions for LaToya Jackson, and he sang backing vocals for David Lee Roth, Rick Springfield, and more famously with Motley Crue on the hit song Girls, Girls, Girls. And he's got a platinum record?
He's got
a platinum record right behind him, overlooking his shoulder for that Girls, Girls, Girls. He's got a great voice, actually. Go check him out online. He's doing Derek St. Holmes' part with a Stranglehold. And online, anyway, he's got a good voice. And he's also backed up Kim Carnes. In 1985, he took a big role with Ted Nugent. And Dave told me that his most memorable tour was in 86 when he sang lead vocals and played guitar with Ted, and they shared the tour bill with Aerosmith.
Right.
And I am almost positive I must have seen you because I saw Ted open for Aerosmith. So I had to be like, and it was during that time. He stayed with Ted for 3 years, making Little Miss Dangerous in 86. And if you can't lick 'em, lick 'em. Due to a conflict of schedules, Dave had to leave Ted in December of 88, and they're still good friends, and they've even shared the stage a number of times since then. Right. Man, I couldn't see any, like, you're just not someone that would ever piss anybody off. I don't imagine that there's too many guys you've played with that, like, oh, Dave Amato's an asshole. I mean, you're just, like, very easy to get along with.
No, I mean, I love music, and I've been just so lucky with the people I've played with that just incredible, you know, people. I mean, I learned so much from Ted Nugent. I mean, Ted Nugent, you know, should be a Hall of Famer for sure. You know, regardless what you think about him, that with his politics stuff.
Sure.
I mean, he led the whole industry in the late 70s. You know, he played stadiums, and he's an incredible, you know, really human being. You know, he's a good father, and I know him because, you know, I kind of, you know, spend a lot of time with him. You know, you really got to know the guy, you know, inside and out. And he's a great guitar player too. He really is.
Yeah,
so,
he really
I
is.
Mean, he taught me an awful lot, man. It was really good that he took me under his wing in the 80s. That was a big learning curve for me. And I just watched him, and he was amazing, you know, and it was still riding high then, you know, Ted Nugent was, and it was an amazing experience for me at the time.
That's awesome. And I'm going to ask you later specifically what you learned because I'm interested in that.
Oh, okay.
In 89, Gary Richrath left REO Speedwagon. There was an opening. Dave joined REO shortly after that, and he's been on all the newer Speedwagon recordings since then. In 91, Dave also worked with Bon Jovi's Richie Sambora on his solo project, and he also toured with Cher. Man, thank you so much for your time. I'm so glad that we got to connect.
Oh, great. This is awesome. It's my pleasure, man. We, you know, like you said, we talked last week, and we becoming good friends. This is really a pleasure, man.
Yeah. We know each other's dysfunctions already.
Oh, boy. Yeah, but you can't put that on air, but okay.
It's amazing how many players, Dave, literally became committed to guitar after seeing the Beatles. And for you, what was it about that event that motivated, like, what was the trigger for you?
Oh man. Just great, great songs and great musicianship. And, you know, I mean, they had long hair and the Beatle boots and the guitars. The guitars, you know, the John Lennon with that 3/4 325 Rickenbacker just knocked me out, you know. And of course, Paul's Hofner, little Hofner bass, mm-hmm. you know, and George with a Rickenbacker 12 string. I mean, that was the first, you know, I've ever seen of that, or the Gretsch Country Gentleman as well. You know, I just wanted to, you know, I just wanted to be the Beatles and to form a gang. You know, they were a gang of four, and you just want to go like, God, I want to do that in my life. You know, I want to get a bunch of guys, a gang together, I used to call it. Yeah. Let's get a gang of guys together. Let's form a band and let's grow our hair and let's try to do this like the Beatles. You know, it was incredible to see that on the Ed Sullivan Show. Changed my life.
Yeah.
I'm sure, and some of the guys in REO too, and I'm sure you talk to a million guys that say the Beatles changed my life. That's what I want to do. That's it. It's over.
Probably 80 to 90% of the guys in yep. your age bracket, literally 80 to 90%, that was the trigger for all of them.
Absolutely. It's just, and still to this day, I still listen to, you know, Beatle records. It's amazing. Even the offcuts are just incredible, you know, so. And nobody writes like that anymore. It's hard to write songs like that. It's just a 2 or 3 minute, you know, ditty little song. But, you know, it's hard to write good songs like that. And I don't hear anybody doing that right now, you know, and it disappoints me because it's hard to do. And they did it like in their sleep. You know, they did like 2 records a year. 2 albums is nuts.
Yeah, that is nuts.
The amount of production they threw out there.
Hey, question for you. You just made me think of something. This is not really similar, but like I write ad copy, and it's oftentimes much harder to write ad copy when you have a little bit of space versus a lot of space. And when you said that, I was curious, is it the same thing with songs? Is it more difficult to write a great 2.5, 3.5 minute song than it is to write a great 5 or 6 or 8 minute song?
I think so, because you want to put, you know, everything you can into that 3 minutes. You know, the Beatles did it, you know, maybe chorus, verse, you know, second verse, another chorus, whatever, and then maybe a little solo in there and then cram it into a 2 minute and 30, you know, 2.5 minute yeah. song versus, you know, a 6 minute. Maybe you can, you know, stretch it out by doing a long solo in the middle or you know, whatever. Maybe you don't have to write as many verses. Maybe it might be more instrumental. You know, you could maybe be more relaxed with it. You know, so I think it's tougher to write a short little song and make it make sense and right and tell a story.
Yeah, I think it is.
It's hard, man. It's hard.
Yeah, I never thought it until you said it, and I think it is because you have to have the same opening, you know, beginning, middle, end of the story, and closing
in 2.5 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I want to show praise to, you know, Kevin Cronin and REO, you know, Can't Fight This Feeling. You know, there's a story there, there's a middle, there's a, you know, and there's an ending, and it's, there's your song. And it, you know, it's a meaning, it may be different meaning to other people, but there's a meaning in there, you know, a lot of REO songs, Time for Me to Fly, you know, those are short songs.
Yeah.
They're not long songs. And I think it's really tough to write a real good song like the Beatles did, or, you know, Kevin and among other, a lot of players. I can't think of right this second, but
yeah,
know,
sure. Though.
You know, good songs are good songs. And if you can cram them into 2.5, 3 minutes, it's like amazing.
Yeah.
I think.
In today's generation, man, that may be too. You need a 15-second song and it capture people's attention. You know,
nowadays, you know, you turn on the drum machine and it's the same beat, you know, same beat through the whole thing, and you make up a couple of words and there's no chorus. There's no what's the hook here? You know, what are you saying? And there's some not to say it's all bad, but sometimes I'd rather listen to a story and get it all in 3 minutes or whatever. Wow. You know, because I think that's hard to do. And I really respect that better than turning on the drum machine and adding a couple of words. And then at the end of it, I go, what is he saying? Yeah. What is she saying? What?
Yeah.
You know,
I'm with you. I agree with you. I'm with you on that.
Yeah.
So in 1980, you moved out to LA. I was curious what prompted the move, and once you got out there, how did you start getting gigs and session work?
Well, I had a manager that managed Black Oak, Arkansas, Butch Stone. We had a band out there in Boston. I was always in a couple of bands, and a couple of my bands opened for Aerosmith. I was friends with the Aerosmith guys. We played high school gymnasiums with that's so far back, like I guess 1973, about the first Aerosmith record. We had a spec deal at Atlantic in New York. We were going to New York, you know, like once a month and cutting some tracks here and there. And it just wasn't, you know, kind of like the couple of the guys in the band were just fighting, didn't kind of disagreeing in this, of course, like a band would do. And then I just went to the manager and said, look, I don't want to fight anymore. I just want to try to make it. And if there's anything out in L.A., because he had some of the Black Oak guys out in L.A. I'm willing to move, you know, I'm willing to go. Well, these guys that I was with weren't that, you know, didn't want to kind of want to be a big fish in a small town, I'd say, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So there was opportunity to go to L.A. and what was left of Black Oak. They were trying to still salvage that thing. And they were looking for a guitar player. And I played a little bit of keyboards on the side, but I was a hack, you know, really kind of having fun with it. But I did a little bit on the side, and I was a singer, background singer too, high, you know. So they got me out to L.A., and I kind of – we all had a band house, and I slept, you know, under a table in a sleeping bag, you know, in 1980. But I was happy to be here, you know, in warm weather, and I was in L.A., you know, in the 80s, which – the start of the 80s, which was just an incredible time in Los Angeles, the 80s, you know. And I did that for a while, but it didn't really work out, and I just kept going on auditions. I'd see an audition in the paper or something, you know, and I'd go on and I'd meet more people. And then I knew how to do kind of top 40. So I did it in Boston. So I joined the top 40 band because they had to make money. Of course, you had to eat and pay your rent, whatever. So, and it was down in Orange County, but I always lived in Hollywood. I wanted to be in the thick of things, you know? So, I thought if I do top 40 in LA, I'm probably going to be seen more than Boston. So I went down there and I got seen by a Jonathan Kagan and Journey, which was huge.
Sure.
Actually, his brother was in another top 40 band down there, and I think I played with Muggs after that too. Muggs Kane, which is Jonathan Kane's brother, he played drums for who are you going to play with? I can't think offhand. Anyway, so he said, you know, Jonathan's wife, they were on RCA, and Jonathan did produce a record, and they're looking for a guitar player singer. So I did an audition, and the next thing I knew, I was in the Tawny Kane band, which is Jonathan Kane's wife on RCA. It was great. And Tim Pierce was the other guitar player.
That's wild.
Fantastic, Timmy. And I learned a lot from Timmy at that time. You know, I just came to L.A. and Tim Pierce was, you know, he played on Rick Springfield. He was doing like Michael Jackson records. He was doing, you know, a lot of sessions. So I just, you know, kept meeting people and climbing up the ladder. It was an exciting time, man. The 80s in Los Angeles was an amazing time.
So you basically were out there pounding it and pounding it, and then it started one thing connected to another.
Yeah, I wanted let's see. We were on tour with Eddie Money with Tawny Kane band. We played, you know, Eddie Money, and I'm not thinking so fast here. Mr. Mister's guitar player. Remember Mr. Mister?
Who is Eddie's guitar player? I interviewed.
That's Tommy Gervin.
Okay, I interviewed a couple of guys that played with Eddie. It was later in his career, though, I think.
Well, you're sending me back, so I'm not thinking about.
He was really big back in the day, Eddie Money.
Eddie Money?
Yeah.
Huge.
Yeah, he was really
big. We opened
for
Eddie Money. Yeah, he was huge. He had, you know, took two tickets to Paradise. He has a bunch of hits.
Yeah. He was a New York City cop.
That's right.
How funny is
that? That's right. I love Eddie Money. I love him. We played a lot of gigs with him in the 90s, you know. Steve Ferris, yes. Stevie. you know, I had just come to L.A. and I'm playing with the Tawny Cane Band, and Steve Ferris took me under his wing from from Eddie Money, because he's playing rhythm guitar, fantastic guitar player. And he said to me, Dave, I got all these sessions in L.A. I'm kind of hooked up and I can't handle them all. This was early 80s. I can't handle them all. And I like your guitar playing. Would you want to take some, you know, some gigs off my hands? It won't be great. You know, it'll be secondhand gigs, but I you make some. I said, sure. And Steve Ferris just, I could eat and do sessions. You know, he was a big influence for me. And he turned me on. He gave me a set of strings. He said, hey, call this Dean Markley guy, because I'll set you up an endorsement, you know. And I was just new in LA, so you have Dean Markley strings, and I've had Dean Markley ever since. So Steve Ferris basically really saved me, man. He get me all these gigs, and I have kudos to him with, you know, Dean Markley strings since 83. I think I started with Dean Markley, and I just kept going from there. All the sessions he gave me were like second rate sessions, but that led to that. That led to that. That led to, you know, it kept leading to better gigs, you know, and better sessions.
Well, plus you got to eat.
Yes, I got to pay my
second
rent.
Rate sessions still pay.
And yeah. and play guitar, do it. You know, I didn't have to drive a truck or whatever.
Sure, sure.
So Steve Ferris was, and he went on to Mr. Mister, of course, you know.
That's awesome.
He did great things himself. I mean, he was a great guitar player. That's so awesome.
So he took you, he was like a mentor of yours at the time.
Yes, Steve Ferris was amazing. He was kind of under Lukather. Okay. You know, he was like Lukather was on top.
Okay.
Steve was kind of under him, like on the second string or whatever. But he was still up there. You know,
yeah,
interesting. Did a lot of sessions. So he gave me, you know, he threw me his crumbs, which was I gladly accepted it.
Yeah, awesome. Hell yeah,
yeah. It was, you know, so I owe him, Steve Ferris, big time.
Cool.
You know,
very
and
good.
I always mention him, and because he got the ball rolling for me in L.A.
I awesome. Think it's important. It's nice to hear that, you know, like I think everybody needs some help sometimes, you know, and it's good that this guy stepped up and did it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you did the same thing at some point for somebody else behind you, you know?
Sure. Yeah. And, that leads me to, you know, I mean, down the road a little bit, but I was playing with Cher in 1989, and Richie Sambora was going out with Cher at the time, and he'd be on my side of the stage watching me, you know. So he said to me, almost the same, you know, the ball kept rolling, you know, for me. And he said, hey, you know, Amato, I really like the way you play, you know. I'm just finishing up my solo record, and I'm putting together a solo band. And I think I want you to play guitar in my solo band. I'm like, yeah, okay, Richie, you know, I mean, he's huge in Bon Jovi.
Yeah,
you know,
he
was humongous. And he was, you know, he was doing a solo record. And so he said, give me your number. I'm like, okay. So he gave me my number. And like a month later, he calls me. He goes, all right, let's go. We're going to New Jersey. Get your gear.
And you're off and running. So you're in a touring band.
Yeah. The first solo tour with Richie Sambora, which was amazing.
How did you get hooked up with Cher?
Oh boy, that's another story. It was everybody in LA. What was this, like 1989? Everybody in LA wanted an audition for Cher. There was 162 guitar players audition. Everybody, and it took months and months of callbacks, months and months. And I do the audition. I go in. They say, you know, thank you. They took a picture of you, which put down your resume, and then you wouldn't hear from him for 3 weeks, a month. I'm like, well, I'm out. And then all of a sudden, the management or whoever would call and say, okay, she wants to see you again. You got to come in, you know. And it got whittled down to groups of like, it was three groups of like the first band, you know, first rate band, and then the second string band, and then the third band. And they took guys out of those three, you know, bands. They put together like little entourages.
Yeah.
So I was lucky enough to be in this second string band, and the drummer Ron Wixo and I, who played with David Lee Roth after that, and Foreigner, a great drummer, she plucked us out of there, and it was 89, and I did it on and off for 4 years, because I'd have to go, and I had REO Speedwagon then too, so I had both gigs. So it's the 80s were incredible, man. You try to do everything you can, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of stuff happened in the 80s. And so I'd go back to REO and we would do a record or a little tour. And then Cher would call or the manager would call and say, oh, she hates the new guitar player and you got to come back. When are you free? So it was pretty good for me to do it for like 4 years on and off.
What and it was fun. Did you get any takeaways from that? Because she was such a massive star.
What do you mean?
Takeaways. Like, remember how you said you learned a lot from Ted? Was there anything that you learned on that gig, like business wise, or just watching her interact with people? Or
I loved her. It was just, you know, the music was fun. We kind of rocked out because she was going with Richie at the time, and it was more rock than I think it is now. You know, we didn't do like Gypsy Tramps and Thieves or something like that.
Yeah, okay.
We were rocking out. I mean, she wanted to rock. So it was really fun for me. You know, I played all the leads and I played with really good musicians then too. So Hugh McDonald was the bass player who just got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Mm.
So Huey was, you know, from Bon Jovi. Richie got him the gig as bass player. And of course, Ron was playing drums. So the rhythm section was basically the three of us, you know, great players that went on and did a lot of other stuff. So I was around great players. I just, it was so fun, you know, playing with great musicians, you know, just elevate your game.
Yeah.
You know, you got to be on your toes, you know. And Huey McDonald from Bon Jovi, he's like a machine. You make a mistake, he's like, looks at you. Like, so you got to be on your toes.
Which is great.
Fantastic.
Which is great. Yeah.
It makes your game, you know, makes your game better.
Absolutely,
you know?
Man.
You're respecting the other guy. You know, like, this, like, he's not going to make a mistake, you know. One time I think I bet him $20. I said, tonight, I'm not making one mistake. You know, I'm like you know, he was like a machine. I'm telling you, the guy's a machine. So, you know, I'm up there and I'm playing about 80% of the show is done. And I'm like rocking, you know, I play some solos. And then all of a sudden, like I just get off on one thing, like, damn, he's like $20. $20, you owe me. Like, shit, you know, this guy's amazing. So. Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah,
he's still a great friend of mine, Hugh McDonald's. Amazing.
Talk about Motley Crue. How did you get hooked up with those guys?
Tom Werman was producing a Ted Nugent record in, I think it was 86, 87. The crew loved Ted. They all loved, respected Ted Nugent. So we were doing pre-production and we were in the same studio and Tom Werman was doing, you know, both bands and he was just finishing up the Girls, Girls, Girls record and they needed some backgrounds on Girls, Girls, Girls and Wild Side. So, and they knew, you know, I was Ted's lead singer and they asked me if you want to sing backgrounds on Girls, Girls, Girls. And I heard the song. I'm like, oh my God, this thing is going to be a smash, you know?
So you knew right there.
I knew the song. It was just, it's incredible. I mean, Tommy Lee was, you know, his drums was just insane, you know? And I watched him in the studio and I loved those guys. Those guys were just great guys and great, I think great musicians and Nikki Sixx and I became friends at the time. And I did the girls record and I sang some more songs about half the backgrounds on the Girls, Girls, Girls record. And then after that, they called me for Dr. Feelgood after that, but I was with REO, so I couldn't do that one. But then Nikki called me to do the demos on Decade of Decadence.
Yeah.
I did too. I did demos. Tommy called me on, I mean, not Tommy, Nikki would call me to do demos on Motley Crue songs. I go in and do the demos. It's so much, one experience.
That's weird. Why would they do demos on their own?
They did demos and some of the demos, you know, stayed on the
Made
on
it.
The record, you know?
Yeah.
You know, some of the songs they might not have used. I don't remember exactly as long time ago what I sang on, but I think one was Primal Scream. I sang with the background says Tommy Lee and I singing Primal Scream, you know, scream, shout, you know?
That's so funny. Said,
and I used to be in there and Nikki would go, he'd be in the control room and go, hey, Dave, this is the crew, dude. You got to bleed. You know, just sing it. You gotta bleed, dude. This is a crew. You know,
that's so funny. So,
I mean, I'd leave there with no voice left for weeks. You know,
this is the crew, so, dude. You gotta bleed.
You gotta bleed. You got, dude. This is the crew. He's like, dude.
That's
you gotta
funny
bleed.
As well.
Come on, Dave. Like so, I'd leave there. And go, hey, thanks a lot. Thanks for the opportunity at the end of the session, man. I would be bleeding for sure, but I love those guys, and they made great records. And Nicky and Tom, all those guys, great guys. And I ended up singing on Vince Neil record too. After that, or something. Backgrounds on I think one song I did afterwards.
One thing very cool about the music industry is that it's if you do good work, people, you get remembered.
Yeah.
Even years later, like, you know, it seems like.
Or I got, you know, recommended, you know, that's, I kept going from one thing to the other, you know, I guess I did a good job. So they liked it and they said, you know, hey, Amato comes in and sings backgrounds or whatever, you know. And on the, I don't know what record it was, but I went in there with the crew and I was just sitting on a chair and doing background vocals while they were rehearsing for, I can't remember what record it was, but, And that was fun. Just hired me for that. No guitar, just sitting on a chair and watching them, you know, write songs, you know. And I really got paid for the day, but I really didn't do too much. Nicky would say, hey, chime in and some background vocals on this. You know, it was so easy and fun to watch him watch the craziness, you know. It was pretty wild.
So like all the stories or the reputation was like legit with those guys back in the day.
Well, I guess, I mean, I don't know, you know, I mean, I've heard the stories too, but I just love the guys. They were good guys, really nice human beings. They were good guys. And I, you know, like Nugent, everybody think, you know, there's different sides that they think Ted Nugent or Motley Crue, like, but they were all good guys, just really nice to me. And I, you know, they were friends of mine. It was really pleasant. I loved them all.
Well, you know, it's interesting what you say about Ted. I think that I saw someone wrote something on Facebook about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and they said, you know, years ago, you'd meet somebody and you'd never think about like what party political affiliation or, you know, what is this guy thoughts? You would just kind of meet somebody and like them or not like them because of, you know, who they were.
Yeah.
And their politics was like a, you know, it's kind of like, you know, who they're married to or who they're dating. That's really not relevant to your relationship.
No, and no, it's one on one. You know, if you like the one on one, you know, of, like you say, of Motley. Yes. The stories, you know, whatever, Hollywood, you know, whatever they did, you know, drugs, hotel rooms or whatever. I didn't associate that. Yeah. I associated with that with Nikki Sixx. With friends, you know, with a guy, you know, and respected his writing and respected, you know, as a musician, and he was a good guy to me. Called me for things, and I didn't ever see him messed up, you know, with me, you know.
Yeah,
he was
sure.
Business and went in the studio, and they made records, man, you know, and Ted Nugent, I've slept on Ted Nugent's couch, you know. Mm. I mean, we were rehearsing in his garage in the back in Michigan. And he'd wake me up in the morning and say, hey, he used to call me Amatsky. Hey, Amatsky, you want some eggs? You know, and it was just him and I. Yeah. And he'd go to the hen, he had hens in the back. He'd go to the hen house and pick up the, and he'd make me eggs in the morning. And we'd wash dishes together with Teddy. Yeah. I'm like, I wish I had a camera on me because, you know, it was like a guy with a guy.
Yeah,
you know,
just doing normal guy stuff.
Yeah, and Ted was a good family man. I've seen him with his family. He was a good down-home country, you know, he lived on a farm, you know, regardless of whether he was a hunter, I didn't care. Right. I wasn't a hunter myself. I didn't get involved in that, you know, or politics with him. You know, I was just, you know, I respected him as a guitar player, mostly music. I wanted, you know, so that's all.
No, I agree with you. And it's, I don't know why that this other like dimension has suddenly, it's just divisive, you know. There's nothing good that comes out, you know, because if you want, you could find something negative in anybody. That's easy to do, man. Sure. You know, you don't like the people they hang out with. You don't like the brand of booze they drink, whatever. But it's just like divisive, man, you know, and I struggle with that at times because I don't care about any of that shit.
I mean, I don't either. I think myself, you know, just me speaking, I think Ted Nugent should be a Hall of Famer from all he's done, how many years he's done it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, regardless of it, but I guess it gets a little bit, you know, clouded with the hunting and the politics, you know, which is, as a musician, he should be a Hall of Famer.
Yes, it's mutually exclusive to his performance as a musician.
Yeah, I respect him, you know, as a Hall of Famer. I'm just looking at, you know, his music, what he's done. Yeah. That's an incredible amount of work he's put out there, you know. And, you know, he led the box office in the late 70s, you know, stadiums. I mean, God, I guess I was there, you know, in the 80s, which he was still riding pretty high, you know, and I saw it with my own eyes. It was incredible how he got a crowd going. It was insane.
And what's amazing is if people think that there aren't other musicians who hunt and who are like politically conservative, you know, that's like saying, you know, oh, there's no gay football players. Bullshit. You know, I mean, nobody in the NFL is gay. You know, of course. I mean, it's just like, you know, people are people, man. You know, it's just no
right. I mean, if he's an incredible football player and he's gay, who cares?
Right? Who gives a shit?
You know? I mean, who cares? He's a great football player, so he should be honored for that. You know, and don't cross. You know,
I know
cross because he's whatever. He's just he's his own person. Leave him alone. You know, if he's a great, you know, if he's a great guitar player, honor him for that. Yeah. You know, because he shoots a bow and arrow or something. You know, come on.
Yeah.
You know, just whatever. You know, I never got involved in that either way with the crew or, you know, for example, you know, the Bad Boys. I don't care. You know, they were good to me and they were good people.
Yeah.
That's all I cared about. They were good people. The Motley Crue guys are good guys and Nugent's a good guy overall. If you knew him underneath, Nugent's a good guy. Really is. He's a sweetheart.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Man. Thank you for sharing that, man.
Oh, no problem.
Talk about how'd you get connected with Ted in the first place? And then talk about, you started telling me a story earlier about turning Ted liked your amps or something like that. So how'd you get hooked up with Ted in the first place? And then talk about the story. That was kind of cool.
I was with Ricky Phillips, who was a great friend of mine to this day.
Sticks. Plays,
you know, bass and Sticks. Yeah. Amazing, amazing musician as well. You know, played with the Babies and what was after that? When Neil Sean and Jonathan Cain, the next band he was in. Anyway.
I know he was with, was with Sammy Hagar, but that's not what you're talking about.
No, with John Waite. After the Babies. Anyway, we play in the Tawny Cain band together, talking about Jonathan Cain. You know, we played together. We've known him for, you know, 30 plus years. And he's a good friend of mine. And he knew Doug Banker, which is Ted Nugent's manager. And he called me up one day and he said, Nugent's looking for a singer guitar player. And I think you should fit the bill, you know.
Ricky called you and told you this.
Yeah, Ricky called me. You know, so he gave me, I think, Doug Banker, if I can remember correctly. I think he gave me the number. So Nugent was doing a record in Burbank, California. And I went down to the studio and there was just me and another guy up for the job. So I went out the job. That was Little Miss Dangerous record. And I sang half the record. When I got there, he said, you know, okay, you're going to be my singer and guitar player. So I did half the record with him. It was just him and I. And a producer and it was like a drummer slash, you know, he was produced a record, co-produced a record too.
Sure.
And it was him and I on kind of two records. We just kind of hired guys on, even though with the lick 'em.
It's crazy, a great name. Title.
Yeah, you've seen the album cover, you know, there's a girl against the ropes, you know, she's laying against the ropes. It's like, if you can't lick 'em, lick 'em. Hello. Ted Nugent style.
Yes, for sure, man.
And we finished the record and he said, that was 1985. And he said, we're going to do one show this year. I only have one show booked because we're going to finish this record this year. And then the next year we went out with Aerosmith, 86, you know, that was a big one. And I said, what is it? He said, we're going to do the Cotton Bowl in Dallas, Texas, 91,000 people.
Wow.
And that was, I said, okay.
You know, so was that the biggest arena you had played at the time, I'm assuming?
At the time, by far, you know. And so I said, well, are we going to do any warm-ups? any warm up gigs before that? And he says, no, I like to break my boys in right. That's what he said to me. I'm like, oh my God. So we rehearsed 5 days in Michigan, and then we went to Dallas because the Cotton Bowl is in Dallas, Texas. We did 5 days rehearsal, we did 10 days rehearsal. And then we did the gigs. It was my first gig with Ted Nugent, 91,000 people. It was like in August, and it was 104 degrees. They were hosing down the people. It was crazy. I mean, my legs were shaking. It was crazy. That was my first show with Ted Nugent. And Tommy Aldridge,
the drummer,
who was in Black Oak, Arkansas, and Whitesnake.
And he played for Ozzy.
Yes, yes.
Holy Tommy shit. Aldridge. He's a monster drummer, that guy. A
monster. He was the drummer just for that gig at the time. That was his drummer at the time. Amazing. Tommy Aldridge. And we became friends, Tommy and I. I love Tommy Aldridge. Amazing drummer.
Yeah, excellent. Amazing. Really good drummer.
And a great and a wonderful guy. Wonderful. So, and Bon Jovi went on before us, before Ted. So Bon Jovi was the second album, you know, so they were just coming up, and they were incredible. They were incredible. So
did you at that time, when you were, did you get to talk with Richie at all? That gig?
Ted, you know, because Ted knew, I mean, I was the new guy on the block with Ted. So Ted used to go, hey, Amatsky, come on, I'm going to take you over to see those Bon Jovi boys, you know. Because here, I tell you, the deal was that Night Ranger was going on after Ted. Mm. And he said, come on, let's go see the Night Ranger boys. So he went over to see the Night Ranger boys, and he said, he went in there. If I remember correctly, I think he said, let's go warn the Night Ranger boys to follow Ted in Texas. You don't want to be following Ted Nugent in Texas, you know? So I think if I remember, he goes, come on, Amatsky, because, you know, he always used to take me over there. So I think we talked to the Night Ranger boys. He said to him, guys, I'm going to give you a fair chance here. You want to go on before Ted in Texas, because you're going to get, you know, it's going to be in trouble, you know? And I think they saw the cat with Jesus. walking on. So I think he said to them, you know, and they said, well, no, Ted, we have Sister Christian, and we got, you know, can tell me you love me, and we got a lot of hits, Ted. You know, we want to keep the where we going. He says, okay, I'm just going to warn you. You don't want to go on after Ted, and you know, see. And then he took me over to Bon Jovi boys, because he said, hey, Amatsky, I like those Bon Jovi boys because they respect Ted. They want to go on before Ted. See, you know? So he went over. We went over to. That's when I first met Richie and the guys, but I really didn't know them. You know, I mean, I've heard of them, and.
Yeah.
And they were great. And John Bon Jovi was really respectful of Ted, and Ted loved that. He said, I love those Bon Jovi boys because they respect Ted.
They respect Ted.
And he loved the Night Ranger guys too, don't get me wrong. You know, but he just said, you don't want to follow Ted in Texas.
That's so funny.
I don't want to tell you what happened, but it was pretty, you know.
Oh, when really?
Night Ranger went on, they were yelling, Ted, 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 Ted. They love Ted in Texas.
Yeah, big because time. It's all conservative fan base there.
Yeah, big time, yeah. Ted. You know, so I think Night Ranger guys said, you know, came back after the show and said, okay, we'll never do that one again, you know.
Yeah, wow.
So yeah, that was a pretty little lesson for, you know, don't follow Ted in Texas.
Texas.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this. So is it like, so years later, when you wind up touring with Richie, does it ever, and it may not be for you because this is like what you do, but do you ever say, shit, here I am touring with Richie, and I met him at that show X, you know, 15 years ago. Is that like that? Not odd, but is it like, you know, funny? Like you think to yourself, God, I never would have expected that.
No. I told him about it. I said, Richie, remember? And Richie's good. You know, he said, yeah, I remember that day. You know, I remember it. I said, remember we came in with Ted? You know, we said hi, and that's the first day I saw him. And I did see him, I think, once or twice at a NAMM show after that.
Okay.
You know, it was so, like, what, 80, let's see, 85. To 89, I guess. So in between that, I think I saw him at a NAMM show or two, and I think I went up to him and introduced myself again, because, I mean, I love Richie Sambora. He's one of my good friends, you know, and I love the guy dearly. And he talk about a great guy. He's an amazing guy, you know, as are the Bon Jovi guys, I think, as well, you know. So no, I to answer your question, no, I never thought, you know, I just thought if I can be friends with Richie because I respect him so much, that would be great, you know. And he's an incredible guy, incredibly nice guy. You'd love him, you know. If you should interview him too. You know, talk about some stories. Wow.
Oh my God, yeah, he's got a bunch. Wow. Of them.
Yeah, I think you should interview him.
All right, like,
that would be.
Let's make that happen.
Yeah, I'm telling you. I'll try to put a few words in for you.
Yeah, man, that'd be awesome. I'd love to have him on the show. That guy Tommy Aldridge, though, he's
a monster,
incredible. Yeah. I mean, he's pushing. I mean, and the bands he played with, driving those bands is not easy.
His feet. When I was with Nugent, because Nugent like double bass drum, you know, Tommy Aldridge's feet is amazing. Yeah. Amazing feet, you know, not to mention his upper, you know, his upper half. But I mean, his feet were just insane. What a freight train!
Yeah,
when he goes, his double bass is going. It's a freight train. It was so much fun. It's such an honor, you know, to play with Tommy. It was incredible, you know, to cut my teeth on the first gig, 91,000 people with, you know, with Ted and Newt and Aldridge playing drums, insane.
So you said earlier, so I want to hear the Marshall story with Nugent, but also you said earlier when we first started talking about how you learned so much from Ted. Can you be specific about that?
Just watching him perform, you know, how he just grabbed an audience at the time. I guess he still does now, but at the time, he just commanded, you know, the audience did anything he told him to do. It was, I guess you had been there at the time, but I remember him going out on the in the Philadelphia Spectrum. I just remember one time he had his Gibson Birdland coming out of the rafters in the ceiling. It was the strap was hooked to a hook, and he used to just come out. No announcement or whatever. The lights went out with one spot, and he'd go to the center of the stage with like one of those Roger Daltrey, you know, with those tasseled jackets on, you know,
yeah, whatever, yeah.
You know, Roger Daltrey used to wear in the like suede, you know, and they go nuts. They just see him, you know, he's 6 foot something, you know,
yeah, he's
and he'd come out there and he just raised his hands up in the air. And the Birdland would slowly come down from the rafters, you know, and the people would go and they'd see there's a spot on the guitar coming down. It just commanded, like the people would go berserko. And he'd unhook the hitch on the strap, you know, put it around and hit an A chord, and they would just lose it. You know, with everything on 10 and blasting, you know, and they would just, and he had them. He didn't even play a note yet. And he had him, you know what I mean? And I just watched that and go, oh my God, that's incredible. You know, the power he had over an audience at the time, you know, was mind blowing. It was mind blowing. Ted Nugent at the time, you know, and when he was younger, I mean, he still does it in a way now, but you know, he's older now, but
sure.
But at the time, and I can imagine in the '70s, I wasn't there, but you know, when he did Stadium, he did stadiums all the time with 60,000 people, 60,000 people. And he tamed them. Anything they wanted, they asked Dad, whatever you want me, you know, to do, you know? So I just saw that and watched him and learned, you know, just his, some of his moves, what he did, how he acted, you know, and just, I just, you know, was writing down in my head, you know, more stuff to do, you know,
yeah.
what was good from him. Because he was a showman and an excellent guitar player, so it was an experience. It was a great experience for me.
Did he write? Did he do all the solos on those songs, like Stranglehold, for example?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
That was him. Yeah.
That was him. Yeah.
Wow, I think that's
Derek played rhythm. Derek St. Holmes played rhythm.
Yeah, that's pretty freaking cool.
Yeah.
It's some real good guitar work on there.
Oh, absolutely! Great, you know, Stranglehold. You know, all that soloing is fantastic.
Great tone, everything. I mean,
great tone. Yeah. Great tone. I think those were Showmans or something. It's like 100 watt Showmans on 10. It's crazy. Oh, you want me to?
Yeah, the Marshall story. Yeah, talk about the Marshall story.
Yeah, we were first rehearsing for the, I think it was for the Aerosmith. I think it was for the Aerosmith tour. Yeah, it could have been for the Aerosmith tour. I had just gotten my Marshall endorsement, and I had these JCM 800 Marshall 100 watt channel switching amps, and they were just new at the time, and I really liked them. And he came over to me, and he liked what I was doing, liked the sound that I was doing. He said, "Hey, Amatsky, what amps are you using?" I said, "These 100 watt Marshalls, and I just got the endorsement." He goes, "Oh, those are really nice. Can you get me a couple?" I'm like, "Well, sure. You're Ted Nugent, of course." and he had a bunch of Marshall cabinets left over. I think he had Marshall heads, but he really liked mine. So I got him two heads, and he shipped them in, and we had them like side by side, and we're just rehearsing before the tour. And I told him, I was like teaching Ted Nugent how to set his amplifiers. Yeah, right. And I said, "Well, this is how I set mine. You know, I got this on that, and a treble on six, and this and that, and the master volumes." And he goes, "Oh, that sounds really good." And he said, he took his amps and he decked every control on 10, right across the board. He said, two Marshall 100 watt heads, in stereo. Yeah, the chorus, he would hip up both of them. And he said, "That's the way Nugent does it."
He just dimed everything. Like bass, treble, everything.
Every knob on the amp was on 10. And then he had this big Birdland, hollow Birdland went, woo.
Yeah, but how did he control that with that hollow?
With the volume. He knew how to handle that Birdland. Everything was on 10. He decked it. He just knew how to handle the Birdland. You know, he just was, and it fed back. That was his, woo.
Yeah.
And he used to pull the six, like the sixth string, like way up high. Woo, he goes, "Hey, Amato, that's my moose call. All the mooses come running when I pull."
He sounded like he was a lot of fun to no shortage of humor on those.
No, he was touring with Ted Nugent was incredible. It was an incredible experience, So, I mean, I just put my hands up in the air. He decked everything on 10.
That's like, hilarious.
Okay, forget it. That's the Nugent way, he said to me. I'm like, "Oh, okay, never mind."
Well, what's really funny is you're like probably really patiently explaining, this is, and I put this on 7, and I could see you being like real thorough. Well, because if you turn this up hot, I could see you just being like very, because you're very right. Precise with all your stuff there. I know you're very deliberate and serious about it. And he's like, "Okay, great."
and he was really patient, listening to me. I went through the whole spiel without him saying a word, and then he took the amp and said, "Well, this is the way I do it."
How funny is that, man?
Okay, I got it. Wow. Okay, and he handled it. I'm like, wow. But it was loud on stage. He had four cabinets spread, two Marshall heads with four cabinets. And they were spread. There was two in the middle behind them, with one a dummy in the middle. So he split that, and they had one far right and one far left 412 cabinet, and it was blistering loud.
And you had two 100 watt heads.
Two 100 watt heads with four cabinets. Oh, yep.
Shit.
Yep.
And what were you playing through? You playing through the same thing?
I had 200 watt heads, but two cabinets.
Okay.
On my head, my side.
That's a lot of volume out there, man.
Oh my God, I definitely lost a lot of on the years with Ted. I definitely lost a lot of hearing for sure.
Wow.
No question. No question about it.
And then how'd you wind up getting hooked up with REO?
Let's see. One of my friends, Jesse Harms, who was playing keyboards with Sammy Hagar, he was a staff writer on Geffen. Mm-hmm. He had a staff writer. He was also playing with Sammy, and he wrote songs with Sammy too. So he was in Sammy's band. But in the meantime, he was he wrote songs for actually he wrote a song "Walk on Water" for Eddie Money, which was a hit. That was Jesse's song, "Walk on Water." It was a great song. So I used to be his demo man. He'd say, "Hey, Dave Amato, I got another song. Come over to my house." He had a studio in the backyard. And I'd come over and play, on his demos.
Yeah.
He always had songs every week. And he used to pay me. And that was another session I did,
Sure, yeah.
And I loved Jesse. He was a great writer, fantastic writer. And So he started, he hooked up with Kevin Cronin with REO, you know, after Gary Richrath left, who was a writer, wrote a lot of great songs in REO. He teamed up with Jesse. I think Jesse knew his wife or his to be wife at the time. I think she worked at Geffen.
Kevin's to be wife.
Yeah, to be.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And I think that's the story. And so she hooked him up with Kevin and they started writing songs. And they needed a guitar player because Jesse's a keyboard player. So they said, well, you know, Amato does all, you know, does most of my guitar playing. You know, he can do anything. You know, so Jesse called me up and said, hey, you know, they need a guitar player for REO, and why don't you learn two of their old songs? And then, you know, here's the demos that Kevin and I are working on. Play some parts on it, because he used to, like, give me freedom to, you know, do what I want on his songs, you know, and he guided a little bit, but like, oh, I love what you're doing. Just do what you're doing. So I guess he liked what I did on the demos with him and Kevin's songs. So I went down there on a Friday and we played a little music. I played a Lario songs and like 1 o'clock. And then Kevin had a basketball court in the backyard. We played a little basketball. And then by 5 o'clock, he says, you want to join the band?
Holy 4 hours shit. Later,
you want to join our speed wagon? I'm like, sure. Okay. But the funny thing about it was that after I told you, backtracking here, after months of doing auditions with Cher, I got the Cher gig on the Wednesday. I swear to God, this sounds like a story. The Wednesday before the Friday, I had the audition with REO.
So you got the gig 2 days before. So you got two major gigs in like 2 days.
In 1 week. Yeah, 1 week. So wow. I had the Cher gig. So I was relaxed. I'm like, well, I got the Cher gig. So I'll go down and you know. And
do you think that helped you?
I think it was more relaxed. I didn't. I'm like, I got a gig already, whatever.
Right.
I was like, you know, calm of like, hey, I did all these auditions with Cher. And I'm like, I wasn't cocky or anything, but I already had the gig.
Yeah. Well, you weren't stressed for like, shit, I got to get this gig because I can't eat. Like,
oh my God. Oh my God. I need this gig so bad, you know?
Yeah.
And so I got two gigs in a week. Now what do? You know, so I had to go back to Cher and quit. Oh, she was mad at me. Woo, was she mad at me? Man. So I had to audition people to replace me, and I had just gotten the gig. God. And I auditioned some of the people that I saw coming in that I auditioned. That you had auditioned.
Wait a minute. So you didn't do any of that? You didn't. I thought you did both for a little bit in the beginning.
I did. I think I, if I, God, all this is a blur behind me here. I think I did a month with Cher because REO had some time off.
Gotcha.
So I think I did a month with Cher. I think she made me. I think I of course I want to try to do everything in the 80s, you know. So I think I fit in like a month with Cher out there, you know, and I didn't. Then I said I have to go back to REO because we were doing a record. We were doing the first record we were, you know, doing with REO, you know, in 1989.
Yeah, so it was serious business pretty quickly with REO.
Yeah, I wanted to, you know, I mean, because they made me a band member right off the bat, you know, and that she said, and Cher said, why do you want to go with REO? I said, well, they made me a band member. That's what the ultimate, you want to be a piece of something. You know, I want to be that's what the ultimate goal is. You know, I mean, I was always a sideman with Nugent, sideman with Cher. I was just getting salary, you know, whatever. Yeah. And with REO, I had a piece of the band,
yeah,
which was exciting to me, you know.
Hell I wanted to keep that.
But I quit and I auditioned people for Cher, and I thought, you picked a good guy. This is all a blur if I remember this correctly, you know. So I picked a guy, and then all of a sudden, a couple of months later down the road, the manager would call me and said, she hates this guitar player guy. What are you doing? Are you free, you know? And I say, well, okay, I got this month off or these. Okay, you come back for that, you know. So I did it on and off for 4 years. It was crazy. You know, when I had time and they'd call me or, you know, and it could be 3 or 4 months span. And then all of a sudden the manager would call me and say, she wants you back. She doesn't like this guitar player again. I'm like, oh, okay, you know, sure. I'll try to fit it in. And then I would coordinate with REO's management, you know, which after 4 years, they didn't like it very much. So they said, you know, you want to be in Cher, you want to be in REO's management. I said, no, I just think, you know, so finally, you know, it kind of ended.
But man, congratulations, because you've been with REO 28 years?
28 years, yeah.
Man,
yeah,
that amazing. Is awesome.
Amazing.
That's like longer than most marriages, man. Good for you.
It is a marriage.
No, it is. It is. Yeah. It is 100%. Congratulations. Yeah, that's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's hard to get along with one person for 28 years. To get along with three or four in the music business, it's to be commended for all of you guys, man.
Yeah. You know what? I got to tell you, it's better than ever. You know, some divorces, you know, they get divorced and it's bad. I mean, we've had our difference in the 90s. You know, we used to fight over what song to play live. I used to fight with Kevin, like, why are we playing that song? You know, it's an off track, you know. Well, I want to sing it because it means something to me. I'm like, yeah, but it's, you know, it's not the right song. Let's, you know, we used to go back and forth a lot on that, you know, but now it's, you know, we're older and I just go, sure, let's try it. I don't care, you know. And I tell you what, I get along with the guys. Well, everybody gets along better than ever. It's really a great family, you know. We've kind of been through the war together, and I don't know. It's been lately. It's been really great. I mean, for years now, not just you know a couple of months.
Or yeah, yeah.
It's been great, and I really enjoy it. I still enjoy it.
Well, I think the key is what you said, man. As you get older, you're like, fuck it. Do I really care what song we play? I mean, you know, exactly. I mean, is it going to alter rock my fucking world if we do this song tonight? No.
Right.
It's just, you let, I don't know. But you let so much shit go and it's for selfish reasons. Cause you're like, I don't need that stress.
Right. Exactly.
You know?
Right.
And it's like not selfish, like at someone's expense, but like, you know, you're making smart decisions for yourself. Like, you know, is that what you really want to stress out of? No. You know, so that's good, man.
I think it worked out, you know, I learned myself because I was kind of a hard ass at first. Like, why are we doing this song? I don't want to do that song. You know, it's just nothing, you know. Now I go, okay, let's try it. And it usually works itself out, even if I don't like it.
Yeah.
You know, it always comes out in a wash. Hmm. Eventually, you know, if Kevin wants to do something, it is like, you know what? Maybe, and I'd say something, I go, I don't know if this is going to work, but I'll try it. You know,
right.
I mean, instead of going like, I hate it, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, you just learn to pick your battles, you know?
Yeah.
And usually what I'm finding out finally after, you know, you just go, it just works out. And Kevin, like, you know what? Maybe you were right in that. Maybe we shouldn't do the song, you know? I'm like, oh, okay. You know, instead of fighting about it, you know?
Yeah.
That's what I find lately. I try it and go and just shut up about it. And then it, you know, usually fits or it doesn't fit.
Yeah.
And that's a better way. I should have learned that, you know, 20 years ago or something.
Man, we all should have. I should have too. I could tell
you're
you
younger,
much,
more
man.
Fiery. You're like, no, let's not do that song. Oh, it's going to kill us. You know, whatever.
Well, you just learn like being right is not that important.
No. That's... No, and sometimes you're wrong. You think you're right, but you're wrong. You know? And
yes.
You know, in Kevin's case, you know, we played a song and it would go over and I'm like, well, I hate this song, but it's going over, you know, whatever, you know, myself. So, you know, okay, whatever. No, I don't dislike the song that I don't like playing it that much, but it's going over. So we, you know, better keep doing it. But usually it works itself out now, you know, but yeah, it's been a great ride with RV Speedwagon. It's been fantastic. I'm sure, you know, and the same with other bands. I'm sure, you know, some guys don't, you know, why are we doing that song? I don't like doing that song, whatever, you know. No, that's it's a marriage, just like
absolutely,
you
know, man.
You know, your wife's doing something that you don't like, and you just shut up about it. And let's see if it works, you know, works it out or not.
Yeah, well, that's what I was thinking of because I was like, yeah, it's the same. It is exactly. It is a marriage, you know. It's a marriage. Yeah. It's a professional marriage, not a personal marriage, but it's a marriage,
exactly,
man. You gotta live and die together. To some extent.
It's a team. Yeah, it's a team. You know, you gotta back each other up. It's. I guess we just realized that more and more. It's just. It's a great group of guys. All the Ario guys are just sweethearts. They really are, and they're friends, and we're brothers. We're definitely brothers after all this time. And it's, wow,
28 years. That's
what a great ride. Yeah. It's a great ride. I'm still having amazing. So,
hey, what are some of the bigger obstacles that you had to deal with? You know, overcome over this time, if there are any. You know,
in REO?
No, or? No. In your music career in general.
Wow. Well, you know, the in-ear, I'm sure other bands, the in-ear thing, you know, from, you know, going from monitors. I mean, I guess, you know, now it's the norm. you know, going from wedges and all that stuff, you know, with side fills and a lot of volume to, you know, kind of cutting it down. I'm sure this, you know, I'm preaching to the choir about everybody here, but the, you know, learning about the in ears, you know, and that was a big catalyst from Kevin. He said, you know, I don't want a messy stage anymore with all these wedges, you know, on stage. And at first I was kind of hesitant on that. And, but then when we cleared them out and we just use, you know, in ears, it's much better. The clean stage, you know, you could hear good. And that was a big thing for me, you know.
Took a while to get adjusted to not hearing. Yeah. Everybody. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, that. It sounded like a little bee, you know, buzzsaw in your ear. And I'm like, this is, I'm hating this, you know, but then of course technology went out and you get better stuff and, you know, technology marches on and now, you know, I'm used to it and it's, and I have some ambient ones too, made with Sensophonics in Chicago, so I can dial in, you know, which when they first started you couldn't do that. You can dial in some of the outside world, so you can hear your amps or whatever, you know.
Oh, that's great! So you can strike whatever balance you need to take everything in and still walk around your environment and feel comfortable.
Right, you can hear the in, you know, as much as you want in or as much as you want out, and I have this. There's a switch on it that Steven Tyler has the same ears as I do, and he has a switch on it. So I guess he can yell at Joe if he wants it. You can switch and his microphone's in it. I don't know. There's a switch on it. You can, you know, talk to people because there's microphones. Usually you just have to take them out to talk to people because you can't hear, you know. Mm. But there's a switch in the back. You could goes right out. So there's microphones on the outside of it. So it's great. You don't have to take them out of your ears.
That's
so Steven
wild.
Tyler added that feature in there, which is pretty cool.
That is pretty cool, man.
Because otherwise you have them in and you go like, somebody's talking to you, hey, you know, tonight, don't play that. And we go, what? Hang on. Take my ears out.
Well, then you got to adjust to get them back in. And it's time. Right. It's time. It's
time. Yeah.
Time consuming in between that. And then you got to make the adjustment mentally with, you know, you're all sorted out after a song or two, then to take them out and then pop them back in. It's
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's pretty cool, man.
Yeah. I think I was the right guy to replace, you know, Rich Rath, because, you know, I use Marshalls and he's just JCM 800s. So the tone was, you know, pretty close, you know, pretty close to me. At the time, with Nugent, I was using a lot of Fender Strats, you know. I was using, you know, Nugent had the Gibson, so I went to Strats, you know. So there's a lot of Strats. And I played a lot of session with Strats because you could get more tones, I guess, you know, at the time, if I remember. And so Rich Rath had, you know, Les Pauls. So I had a couple of Les Pauls, but now I got it was crazy. So, you know, it was a nice, now I collect them. Now I just love Les Pauls, you know, which I've had, I played, you know, all along, but I seemed to lean in the 80s towards Strats versus Les Pauls at the time. But when I joined REO, it was full throttle and Les Pauls.
I think you have another guitar left in you. I don't know, man. I think there's another version to allow your collection to bloom, man. Like maybe
you think so?
Yeah, like Gretsch or something, you know.
Oh, boy.
You got something else in you. You got at least one more guitar.
Well, I've got my signature.
That's right.
It's a Les Paul now, you know, so I'm deep in, you know, in the cement with Les Paul for sure.
That's,
you know,
very true. Very
my
true.
Own, you know, Dave Amato Les Paul access, you know.
Let's talk about that for a minute. And let me just tell everybody who plays guitar, Dave's got a beautiful, it's a custom Gibson Les Paul. It's a single humbucker. It's kind of like a, you know, an old school junior kind of, right?
Yeah. Based on a junior. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's beautiful. It weighs 7 pounds. Comes in HDTV yellow with beautiful quilt. But he's got another color coming out. It's literally the nicest sunburst I've ever seen. Single pickup, classic 57 plus with a Floyd Rose. Talk about the guitar, how you designed it. It's just gorgeous, man.
Well, Gibson asked me, they were trying to beef up the Axis series. And, you know, they're all two pickups. I think Alex Lifeson of Rush has one, but he has like a piezo acoustic pickup in it. You know, it's kind of like his own design there. And I was one of the first ones to play that. I really like myself. I really like a Floyd Rose on a Les Paul. It's just kind of fun to, you know, you get the Strat feel. I guess that came from the 80s with me with a Strat. So I wanted the Floyd Rose on a Les Paul. So I put it on one of my regular ones in the probably 90s. I attached the Floyd, but it didn't sit well because of the contour of the Les Paul. But they made the axis is a little bit more styled for the Floyd Rose on there. So I was one of the first ones to promote that because I really wanted Floyd Rose on it. And then they came to me. I mean, I wanted my own model. And they said, well, you know, we've got a bunch of axes with two pickups. So they said, can you come up with a different idea? And I said, well, yeah, I'd like to have a one pickup one, you know, just based on kind of a junior. So it, and the old TV finish, which I have a couple of old 50s.
Oh, you TV do? The TV yellow. That is so TV yellow, yeah. Freaking, oh, God, I love those guitars.
I love those guitars. They're like my favorite.
Yeah.
So I kind of based it on the, you know, the 50, like 55, 56 TV model. But I said, let's make it updated. Let's put some flames in it. Let's try to put flames. So they named it HD, which means the flames are in it because the TV yellow didn't really have any flames. It was just kind of yellow, you know? Right. So they went HD TV yellow. And I told them I'd like to put a one pickup because there's not any production model with a one pick. I mean, guys, I think Billy Gibbons has one with a, you know, he just makes a one off. Joe Perry, I think, has one single pickup humbucker in a Les Paul or whatever. But I said, I want to make a production model with the, you know, Floyd Rose. So Gibson really went for it. And then Philip Wharton, which is my cohort there in Gibson, found a batch of, white ebony in the back somewhere. I don't know, in the back of the building. I don't know where he found it, but he said to me, and I love ebony necks, but I thought you'd just put a rosewood on it. But he said, let's make it special. You like ebony? I said, I love ebony. Custom guitars, you know, Les Paul customs are beautiful ebony necks. So he said, I found a batch of white ebony. I said, oh my God, what is that? You know, what's white? So he said, look, let me put it on there. If you don't like it, we'll rip it off and we'll put some, you know, something else on there, you know, rosewood. And so he put it on there and it kind of looked like a maple neck, almost like a maple neck Strat. And I went, oh my God, it's too late. He goes, no, let me dummy it down. You know, let me put some stain on it. And it looked really, you know, really cool. And it is. So he sent me the prototype and it is, it's white ebony. It's never been on a Gibson guitar before, never put on there. And still nobody has it on there. So I'm the only guitar that has white ebony neck. And it's a real ebony. And it's fast and it feels like ebony. It looks a little whiter, but it's still ebony on there. So, you know, it's an expensive neck. And they sent me the prototype and they said, any changes? And it was so perfect. I said, no, let's just make them. Let's go. So and Gibson was happy with it. I'm ecstatic about it. And I think it's a great guitar. And it's for basically, you know, it's a hot rodded guitar. Basically, it's for lead players because they only have one pickup and a Floyd Rose. And it's got a 57 classic pickup in the bridge humbucker. And it's got a split coil tap on the
Classic Plus, right?
Classic Plus, sorry, yeah, yes. Yeah. And it has a push pull on the tone pot because it doesn't have many tricks on it. I had to put something else on it, you know, to have some fun with. So. And Gibson Elwood has a 58. It's based on a 58 historic neck, so it's a little fatter, but it's beefy. It sounds just incredible. So, you know, Gibson, I'm honored to have a Gibson guitar. It's great.
And it weighs 7 pounds.
Roughly, yeah. Roughly around 7 pounds.
And what I like about with the Floyd is how they routed it out there. So now it sits just perfectly. And it's not invasive. It doesn't get involved and it functions properly, you know? So
versus, you know, I put one on, you know, an old Les Paul of mine, I mean, probably 90s or whatever it was, 80s. And it sat up really high because of the contour of the old, you know, the regular standard Les Pauls, you know, so the Gibson fixed that and it lays pretty flat, but you can still, they carved out the body so you can still pull up or down, you know. And the sways, I like it to sway a little bit up and down, you know, via maybe Eddie Van Halen or whatever, you know.
Sure.
But yeah, so, it's a lot of stuff you can do with it. So for one pickup guitar.
Yeah. So anybody who's in the market for a new Gibson, check out the Dave Amato Custom Signature Les Paul. I got to see. And he's got another color, hopefully soon coming out. It's a actually one of the prettiest sunburst guitars I've ever seen. It's kind of like it's a beautiful sunburst. It's cherry, but it's not cherry. It's just gorgeous, man. Literally the nicest sunburst I've ever seen.
Thank you. So, that's pretty. I got the green light. I'm pretty close to getting it done. They're going to tell me this week, but I think it's going to happen. Definitely think.
Awesome. So check out Dave's guitar, the Dave Amato Gibson Les Paul. Beautiful freaking guitar. Hey, question for you. If you know, we talked about this a few minutes ago about being a little smarter now with bullshit decisions like argument over songs. But if you could go back and give advice to your younger self, you know, younger Dave Amato, what advice would you have given that you think you could have helped, you know, would have liked to hear or would have benefited from, maybe didn't want to hear it?
Wow. That's a loaded one. You know, I did things, I don't know if I change a lot. You know, I did things
great,
pretty well. You know, all the rungs of the ladder, you know, you know, I did anything I could. I didn't say no to anything. You know, I never said no. I just went for it. I think that's a good lesson for maybe a younger, you know, a younger guy coming up. You know, don't say no. Just go for it. Even if you think it's not going to be good, try it because you'll get something out of it. I guess I'm going to, you know, repeat myself again, which was kind of stubborn with, you know, with REO or something, you know, just opinionated or something, you know what I mean? I mean, maybe a little bit more open to stuff like I am now, you know, I guess that comes with age, right? I mean, yeah. for everybody, you know,
I think so.
I guess that might be the biggest thing. I was pretty kind of stubborn, you know,
Man, my opinions, you, I guess. That is, I'm surprised to hear that, but I guess we all change, but that's really shocking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm seeing, Dave 2.0.
Well, not all things, but I guess I could have been, you know, I mean, I liked the ladder that I climbed, you know, I was open, but sometimes I get into a situation that I mean, not that anybody be mad, but I just thought, you know, I had opinions on stuff. Maybe I shouldn't have been that opinionated, you know, I should have maybe been a little more open, but I guess that's youth versus a little bit older, you know, yeah. I guess, that's about all I can think of. I think I picked, you know, my choices for equipment or whatever. You know, I definitely, when I wanted something and I stuck with it, I wasn't, you know, I've seen a lot of guys, I'm not going to mention any names, but they jump. They just jump from one company to the other. I'm not happy with this. I'm not happy with that. I didn't do that at all. You know, when I liked something, I stuck with it. When I wanted a Marshall endorsement, I wanted it bad in the 80s and I stuck with it and I'm still there, you know, and, you know, a Strat and a Fender, I didn't go really, you know, off brand. I mean, I have a couple of Nash guitars, which Bill Nash is a good friend of mine, which that's my only off brand guitar really right now, you know, and I love Bill Nash and his guitars are fantastic. So, but, you know, mainly for me is Gibson first and then Fenders, I like Tellys, and I got some Gretches and Rickenbackers, of course, you know, but I'm like old school. I don't try a lot of, you know, the new stuff because I like where it came from.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah. It came from, you know, Jimi Hendrix and Eric Clapton in the 60s. Yeah. What did they play? Okay, they played Les Pauls or Strats or Tellys, and they went through Marshalls. Marshalls. Like, hello, it's a no-brainer, you know? So, anyway, I got to have equipment, but that's, you know, that's where I'm at. I like to be loyal. I want something, and I stick with it that I like, you know?
Let's talk about gear for a minute. Now, I got to tell people that you have, like, just a majorly very cool collection of guitars, so this question's probably really difficult to answer, but I know that your signature model is your go-to guitar, but after that one, what would be your top three go-to guitars right now that you just like to pick up and feel good?
Well, I have a 59 Les Paul custom shop 59 that that they sent me out in the 90s. It was beautiful wood. In the 90s, they were really had some beautiful striped wood. And I would probably, that's other than my signature one, that's my second go-to one, you know, with REO and on the road. It's probably a 59 Les Paul. And I have some 58s after that that are just absolutely gorgeous too. I have one song I mentioned before, Back to the Strat Thing. I like to keep that around because I still love, you know, I love Strats too. And I have one with a Floyd Rose with a Seymour Duncan 59 humbucker in it that I play in one song that I just have a lot of fun with. I mean, I can, you know, rock out and beat the heck out of a Strat for one song, you know, which is fun, which I played, you know, in Nugent or whatever, you know, in the 80s. So I kind of keep that because that's close to my heart too. You know, I have a lot of Strats too, you know, from collecting wise too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have a 54 Strat first year.
Oh, wow.
I like to get the first year of stuff. I don't know what that means, but like the first year off the line, a 54 Strat, you know?
Well, that makes sense, man. People are like, if you collect comic books, you like Daredevil or Spider-Man, you want to get Daredevil number one or Spider-Man.
Number one, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I totally
get that. Or 52 Gold Top Les Paul, I got that too. You know, just
you
the
do?
First year.
Wow.
Yeah. It's got a trapeze tailpiece. You can't really play it because it's the wrong way, you know, it's the wrong, but it's, you know, it's a first year. And then I have a couple of Les Paul Juniors, which are 54s as well, first year. So I just like to say I got the first year of, you know, when it was started, really.
How do those juniors sound?
Amazing.
Yeah, I love those guitars, man.
Six of them. It's amazing.
Wow.
They're amazing. I can't play it with our, I mean, I could, I guess, but I lean towards humbuckers versus the P90s.
Oh, is P90 in all of them?
Yeah, the early ones are P90s, yeah. But they're strong, and the 50s ones are amazing. Amazing. I like to collect them versus playing them, you know. I think Johnny A, buddy and Johnny, yeah. I think he did an interview with, yeah. He likes the P90s, the junior P90s. You know, yeah. I think he just came out with a signature one. He had a couple made just now. Yeah.
I think he's got an Epiphone one.
Oh, is it Epiphone?
I think so. I think so. Cause his Gibson one.
He's got a couple of juniors too. Gibson juniors, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I didn't know that. Okay, cool.
I think he's trying to call it the Yardbirds ones because that's what he plays in the Yardbirds.
Yes. Okay, maybe. Yeah. Yeah, he did mention something about that.
Yeah, so he likes the junior with the P90s. You know, I like the humbuckers, so I stick with the standards and my, you know, my guitar's got a humbucker.
Yeah, I prefer humbuckers as well over P90s.
Yeah, I prefer them, but I love the – if I collect the old ones, I got a bunch of 50s. They got P90s that just killer. Just killer. I use them in the studio or I just played at home, you know, whatever.
So cool, man. You got like a museum there, man.
Oh, but, you know, I have fun with mine. You know, there's guys with, I mean, Bonamassa is just ridiculous. That's ridiculous. It's, you know, and Sambora's got a
big collection.
Oh, my God. Yeah. He's got amazing stuff. You know, Flying V, late 50s Flying V, Explorer. He's got
like, those are great because those Flying Vs, the old ones, are totally different than the new ones.
Yeah, if you can find them. I mean, they're ridiculous money, you know. I don't have anything like that, but I got my share.
You got some great ones. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Is there anybody who influences your playing, Dave, that people might be surprised to hear?
You know who first did, and which is probably not in my wheelhouse right now, but Ritchie Blackmore was huge with me when I was younger. Ritchie Blackmore, you know, I guess that's the Strat thing, you know, which I guess, you know, with REO, I'm a Les Paul guy now, you know. So, I mean, I was always a Les Paul guy too, but when I saw Ritchie Blackmore when I was younger play a Strat through a Marshall and he'd throw it up in the air and bust it on the stage, I just thought, I want to do that, man. Ritchie Blackmore was just my idol, which I don't think, like you said, I don't think anybody would know that from my playing now, you know?
You know, it's funny. Literally yesterday, I read an article. He's in like this month, one of the guitar magazines, and he was saying that in the beginning, the very beginning when he switched over to Marshalls, because he always used to play Voxes, he wanted to play Marshalls, but they couldn't make a Marshall that sounded, so they took the innards of a Vox out, put it in a Marshall cabinet, and in the beginning, he was playing Voxes in a Marshall cabinet.
Yeah, I was
wow. like, yeah, that was really interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah, and he goes, shortly afterwards, they were able to, you know, he goes, I wanted a Vox sound. I just wanted a Marshall look.
In a Marshall, yeah.
Yeah, it was really funny. And he said, you know, shortly afterwards, obviously they developed their own, you know.
Well, he had the super, the 200 watts, the major.
Yes. Yes.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Right. 200 crazy. Watts. It's all in the article. It was in, I think, this month's Guitar Magazine, maybe.
Yeah. So I don't think that would, anybody yeah, would know that about me. That was a good question, because I don't think I've ever been asked that question. Richie Blackmore, big influence when I was younger.
Great
big.
Guitar player, man.
Yeah.
Great
I mean, guitar player. Of course, Jimi Hendrix and.
Yeah,
and
the usual.
And I think Jeff Beck is God.
Oh, I right agree now. With you. Yeah.
Jeff Beck. You know,
I agree with
you. Is that bad to say? You know, I think Jeff Beck is, you know,
no,
Clapton used to be God. I don't think Clapton anymore is God. Jeff Beck is God.
No, he's the most. I interviewed two of his guitar players. I interviewed Jennifer Batten and Carmen yeah. Vandenberg, and I was like, man, how does he do that? And they were like, fuck if I I studied it for three. Jennifer is brilliant guitar player.
Oh, I love Jennifer. I've seen Jennifer with Beck, as a matter of fact. She's amazing.
Yeah, and even she was like, you know. it's Jeff Beck, but they both. One thing they said was, he is never not without a guitar in his hands.
Really? Wow. Well,
so he, even him, he has to work at being Jeff Beck. Is the bottom line? You know, I mean, it's you know, you don't just fog a mirror and say, oh, I can play like Jeff Beck. This is an right. ongoing, you know, never ending thing. And they said he's playing all the time.
He's just like, you know, there's the top of the ladder, and then he's just,
yeah.
there's no rungs to get there.
Yeah.
You know,
no, I agree.
There's no rung. He's up there somewhere. And how old is he now? Seven? I don't know.
70. 70. And when you consider he's doing all that without a pick, it's nuts.
It gives me goosebumps. Yeah, yeah. I mean, to think about him, you know, when I see the videos and I saw him, Sambora called, this was years ago. Sambora says, hey, I got an extra ticket to, we're going to Jeff Beck, whatever.
Wow.
You know, down in LA. You want to come? I'm like, well, do I? Sure, yeah. Let's go. So I went with Richie and we sat next to each other and just watched him. This is years ago. And just watched him go. And he had the Strat into a Wah-Wah, into the front of a Marshall. That's it.
Yeah.
We tracked it, you know. Front of a Marshall, 412 cabinet. I don't know. It was a DSL head, 150 maybe. I think it was 50. And he just did some things. And Richie, when I was like, what did he just do there? I said, I don't know what he just did there. Yeah. I can't believe what he just did. And Sambora goes, we should quit. We should give up. So, you know, we should give up. We can never go. How do you got to achieve that? It's insane what he was doing.
Really
alive.
Cool.
You know, other than even on videos, he's amazing. He's on another planet.
Yeah, I agree with you. Another guy that was like that I thought was Roy Buchanan, to be honest with you. But you know,
he's
been gone a long time. But yeah,
sure,
he was very similar to that. I don't think he was. I think Beck's taken it to another level, but Buchanan was like certainly, along that plane, man.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. I agree. I agree with you. You know, when I was a kid, you know, Leslie West was, you know, there's an SG player, you know, with a tone. You know, when I was a kid, I was like, wow, Leslie West, you know, I mean, I have a lot of influences, but I think Richie Blackmore was at the time was just like, I want to do that. You know, he'd throw his Strat up in the air and try to catch it, and it would hit the floor and bust off a piece of Strat, you know, and then he'd go to his roadie and he'd pick up another one and try to catch it. And I thought, well, that's like insane. Yeah. You know, I used to go see Deep Purple all the time and go, that's amazing. He's amazing. You know, of course the Marshalls, he'd been, you know, butting his Strat up against through the Marshall cabinets and busting the grill cloth off. I'm like, wow, I want to do that.
He's touring now.
Yeah, I heard.
He's playing Rainbow songs.
Oh, is he okay?
He's doing old Rainbow stuff and just like not like a full blown tour, but just here and there. I think he's, you know, six or seven dates or something like
that. I'd like to see him again. That'd be interesting.
I'd see him in a heartbeat, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Musically, if I asked you to pick your top three Desert Island discs in no particular order, and knowing that you can change tomorrow, what would, like, what's your knee-jerk reaction? What would be the first three albums that come to mind right this minute?
Oh, man. Oh, boy. Well, it'd have to be a Beatles record for sure.
Yeah, I figured
for me.
That. Yeah.
God, it, you know, it's so close with all these, you know, Beatles, Revolver or something like, you know, Revolver or Rubber Soul. You know, I mean, I could say all of them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Jimi Hendrix, Are You Experienced? Great oh, come album. On.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, God, I'm thinking back, right? You know what I mean? I'm going
sure
back to what influenced me. Probably, you know, Machine Head, maybe from Deep Purple.
Deep Purple,
maybe.
Great album.
Machine Head, probably, you know, I don't know, you know? What a record. I'm sure, you said top three, I mean, I probably got a dozen of them, you know what I mean? Just, I'm just off the top of my head here, I don't know.
That's cool. You know? Good music, man.
You know, as a guitar player, I guess, leaning towards, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, Hendrix, you know, yikes.
Yeah, that Are You Experienced album was pretty phenomenal.
Wow. Yeah. You know, when I was a kid, gee whiz, I couldn't even fathom what he was doing. You know what I mean?
Even the album cover itself. Do you remember that double album gatefold? It folded out. That was so cool. With all those, you know, like half, they were all naked. All the girls that were naked on it. It was just like nothing. You didn't see anything like that.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And Rubber Soul, it came out like at Christmas time when I was a kid. I looked at that record for about a month every day just to look at that hair in the front and, you know, just read the liner notes about 18,000 times.
Yeah.
You know, just a Rubber Soul was just, oh my God, you know, just, I don't know. But all the records, the Beatles records are like that for me. But I just remember Rubber Soul and then Revolver. It was kind of like, even George Harrison said, Revolver and Rubber Soul were kind of like it's a double disc.
Mm.
You know, they just went from, you know, Rubber Soul to Revolver. It was kind of like the same, you know, they had all these songs.
Yeah, it wasn't a dramatic change of, you know, it wasn't like Sgt. Pepper's or something like that.
Right.
Yeah,
no, it was the same.
Continuum. Like
Harrison said, I read an article, he said it could have been the same record. Could have been a double record, double album. So, amazing songs, every song. So, I guess I'm probably missing. People are going to go like, well, there's plenty of other.
No, well, it's just knee-jerk reaction right now, man. That's all.
Yeah.
That's it. Tough question. What do you like most about yourself?
Wow. That's a tough one. Shit. I don't know. I think I'm a good person. You know, I get hired because I can get along with people and I just love and, you know, dealing with music. I love music so much and guitars and it's easy for me to fall into that, you know, with other musicians or maybe a situation. Like, I guess that's why I got a lot of sessions because, you know, I enjoy playing so much and, you know, I like the challenge of it. I like challenges. Like, you know, I'm doing this Vegas thing at Rock Vault. And it challenges me that I love it so much that I'm going this coming week. I'm going back to Rock Vault because I love it so much, and the guys are so great, and I like you know interacting with other musicians. You know, I like that, and I don't know about myself. I don't know. I guess
you didn't answer the question yet. You know that, right?
I know. That's a tough question. I like about myself. Oh my God, I never been asked that. I don't know.
Well, the next question not getting any easier.
Oh shit! I think what I like about myself. Wow, I think I enjoy. I don't know if this is. I don't know if this is answers the question. Even I enjoy life, man. I enjoy my life. You know about. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, I think that answers it.
I enjoy life every day. You know, I'm living in California. This. Sunshine out my window and I'm playing guitar for a living and I have a lot of guitars and I'm doing what I want to do. You know, I enjoy me for, you know, what I've done, I guess, you know, what I've gotten this far and I still want to go father, you know?
Sure.
I don't even know if that answers anything.
No, it was close enough. I'll give you a pass.
I enjoy this life I've got. I really enjoy what I've accomplished, I guess, you know?
You're a very optimistic guy in general. Your outlook on things is really optimistic. And I would bet. Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, and that, as somebody dealing with you, that's a real, it's great to be around people like that, that are, you know, that are optimistic, that are looking at the glass half full, that aren't, you know, fucking, you know, miserable and just, you know, that's a real appeal, man.
Thanks. Yeah. You just answered
I answered it. I answered what I like most about you.
I don't want to say that about myself. I just enjoy what I do, and I enjoy every day in life. And I'm a lucky. I consider myself an elite. It's the elite to play music and make money, and I can buy these craziness, the amplifiers behind me, and it makes me happy. You know, it's great. What's not to be happy about?
I hear you, man. And that's not to say what's really cool about that is, you have the same bullshit everybody else has to deal with in life, but you're not focusing on that. You're focusing on the good things, which is awesome.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. That's what's cool.
I think you answered it for me. It's a
group project. It takes a village.
Takes an army.
It takes a village.
There you go. It takes a village.
How about this one? If you could change one thing about yourself, what would that be?
You're killing me.
Dave is actually turning red. This is quite interesting.
I think I am.
Yeah, you are.
Oh, man. Wow. I've never been asked. These are good questions. I've never been asked these questions. I swear to God.
Good.
Change one thing. I guess I kind of changed it already. You know, I like I said, I'm a little more open to things, not so hard-headed about, you know, I mean, not about life or anything, just about maybe situations, sure. You know, mostly, well, maybe personal too, you know, about personal. I get kind of thick-headed sometimes about things, you know, my own way, but I kind of loosened up on that. So I've kind of dealt with that, you know, in my life you know, maybe not 100%, but I'm trying to change, you know, trying to get better or whatever, but
yeah, man.
But I'm pretty positive on things, I think, you know, so I'm not saying I got flaws, but I don't have any flaws, I should say, but I do.
I think you'd actually be good to run for office because you just didn't answer both of those questions in a very, in a very positive way. Like, I got nothing to say.
Because I'm talking, you used to ask me to talk about myself, and yeah. I'm like,
How about this one? Tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
You're killing me with these questions. Oh, man. I don't know, stupid. I like cats. I got two cats in the house here. That'd be like, what does he like cats? Really? He doesn't like a dog, whatever. I like animals. I love all animals.
Yeah, that's cool.
I don't know. It's God, that's probably a stupid answer.
No, it's a good answer. No, man, there's no right or wrong answer here. There's only the truth. Yeah. That's the whole thing about this show. There's only the truth.
I'm an animal guy. I love animals. You mm-hmm. know, I have two cats in here. I can't have any more animals. I probably gonna have more, but I go on the road all the time, and I live by myself here. So,
yeah,
you know, I have two of them that are friends of mine in here. That's kind of fun. There's one right there. I like hot cars too, but they might know that already. You know,
mm-hmm.
I like Corvettes. I'm a Corvette guy.
What's there not to like about that, man?
I know exactly. I know.
I'm assuming you're talking about like old Stingrays.
Oh, old Stingrays. Yeah, yeah. I love it. Yeah, yeah. I have, you know, relatively new one, a 15. Corvette Z06, you know, which I like the fast one, 650 horse. I like that.
It rocks. 650
horse. 650
horse. That's like having a 200-watt Marshall in your engine.
You well, know? I love that too. It's like cars and guitars, which they probably, you know, I'm not well rounded. I kind of, like I told you, I like what I like.
No,
I kind of just stick with that. It's not. I don't invent the wheel. I really like what I like, and it's kind of a narrow field, you know. But I'm happy with what I got, you know.
Yeah, that's all that counts, man. So I'm going to ask you just three more questions here. Who's had the biggest influence on your life? Person who's had the biggest influence on your life?
Oh wow, my parents for sure. My parents, they, you know, my we used to rehearse in my basement, you know, back in Boston, and it was just, you know, we always had my band downstairs, you know, the whole basement was for me to do what, you know, what I wanted down there. It was just let me be me, you know? And so I had a good upbringing. I had great parents, no brothers, no sisters, just a mother, you know, my mother and father. And,
are they still around?
No.
Sorry about that. Away.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. No, a long time ago. Hmm. Yeah, my mother was a really good influence, you know, because of course in the '60s, you know, when you started growing your hair, you know, my dad would think like, "Oh, you're smoking pot," you know, like, you know, and my mother would say, "No, he's not. He's downstairs. He's practicing his guitar," you know. And it's like my dad thinks when I grow, you know, at that time when you grew your hair, you were smoking pot or whatever.
And you're a communist.
Yeah, communist. That's true. You know. But my mother would go, "Leave him alone. You know, he's downstairs. You know where he is. He's listen to him. You know, he's playing through a Marshall downstairs, you know, and he's knocking the glass off the shelves, you know, because 100-watt Marshall, you know, and goes going deaf then." So she was a big influence, you know, a big catalyst on giving me the green light, you know. Mm-hmm. My dad might have been a little bit more stubborn because of the drug thing, you know, 60s drug thing, whatever. Sure. But I wasn't like that. I never was. So, but my mother would go, "Leave him alone. He, you know, he's right there. He's playing his stuff, you know." Mm. So it was good. And but he was good too, because he let us, you know, the bands downstairs, you know.
Yeah.
All my bands, you know. "All right, you can rehearse in the cellar," you know.
That's great.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Do they have basements in California?
No. Well, very seldom. They have like, no, not really. Mine's a slab here. My house is a slab. Not really. Yeah, no.
I didn't think so.
Because earthquakes.
Yeah, well, they don't have them in Florida because we're so close to sea level. So I was just curious.
We have earthquakes. Yeah. So it's pretty much a lot of slabs, you know?
Mm, sure.
A couple of them have like crawl spaces, you know, so you can put the pipes or whatever. But they don't. I don't really know anybody that has a basement.
Yeah, I didn't think
around
so.
Here. You know, it's all different. But back in Boston, you know, everybody had basements.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Same in New York.
Yeah. So.
Most important lesson your business has taught you?
Well, to keep believing in what you're doing, you know, keep just you mean the record business or
music business?
Music business. I think just keep believing in what you're doing. If you believe in yourself, you know, I think it'll be honest and you'll make something of it. You know, the business is really, especially now, the business is really hard.
Yeah.
You know, so but I'm still, you know, we're still chugging along and we're still doing what we're doing and we're making a living at it and. You know, just believe in yourself. Don't give up, you know, because it's the record business is extremely tough, especially at this point. You know, people are making their own records in their houses and it's so tough to, you know, there's no more record deals. I guess you can get a record deal, but, you know, it's crazy. So I think just, you know, believe in yourself, I think, taught me most. Just believe in yourself and keep going, you know, and. I've never changed. I'm still doing, you know, what I did all along.
Hmm.
You know, not much has changed really in the design of what I, you know.
Yeah, yeah. In the framework of what you do.
Framework. Oh, here comes.
There goes your cat, man.
Here comes the other one.
There you go.
He's coming across my path here. Here we go.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. And then the last question, which you've kind of answered, but. Revisit it. What's been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years and how much of this has been deliberate and how much is just a part of aging? Again, you've answered some of this. If there's anything else you can talk about, if not.
Wow. These are questions I've never been asked before.
That's good.
Which is kind of just looking at myself here. Like it's like a therapy session.
Do you know who Doug Bossi is?
No, I know the name, but I don't know.
He's out in California. Great guitar player. He said a fantastic guitar player, really good guy. He said, he goes, I think your show should be called Everyone Loves Guitar, and then in brackets, and therapy.
You know what? Let me say that too. I hope this is on record because so I'm looking at myself here going, oh my God, I got problems.
No. Oh my God. Hell no. God.
I got problems here. I better fix it.
No more than any of us, any of the rest of us. That's God. For sure.
Wait a minute. What was the – I forgot the question.
The question was, what's been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of this has been deliberate and intentional on your part, and how much has just been a part of aging?
Oh, my God. This is a therapy session. I think I owe you some money. How much am I going to charge for this? That's pretty good.
Dave Amato custom signature. Expensive therapy.
Expensive therapy. How much for the session, for sure? Well, I think it comes, like I said, I think, like you said, I answered this before. I think it comes with age. You know, you get more mellow and you get hopefully smarter, yeah. Which, you know, I don't know how smart I'm getting, but in dealing, you know, with your fellow bandmates or dealing with people, you just maybe more patient or more considerate or something, you know, I guess you learn as you go. Like I said, you know, with the band, you know, pertaining to the band, you know, I don't fight so much with songs, you know, what songs Kevin wants to play live or whatever, you know. Hmm. I mean, we even jostled with it last year. We had two songs that he wanted to say that I didn't feel like it was in this. I feel like it slowed the set down in the middle, but he wanted to say something, you know, and these songs that he picked said something which is meaningful to him, you know, to his person, you know, his person. He wanted to get that out to the public, which I thought it slowed the set down, which I think it did, you know, but he wanted to say something because he had to get it out and say something to him. So I let it go versus, you know, 10 years ago, I would have bucked him on it and said, well, why are we doing that? You know, that doesn't, the set is going downhill and not paying attention to his feelings.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think I'm more considerate of feeling. I still believe in my therapy session. Cause I think I need some more work on that, but I think I'm trying to be more considerate, you know, in my feelings, and instead of being there, you go for the stubbornness about me, you know, I'm like just going, you know, the set's dying. We got to take those songs out no matter what you think, you know, about it. I'm not considering his feelings about what he wants to say in those particular songs.
Yeah.
So I think that's a big change in me. It's kind of taking a breath, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Not
jumping like 10 or 20 years ago. I just jump. I'd probably bite your head off, you know, like.
That's so interesting. Yeah. I'm seeing the flip end of that, man. It's really hard to imagine that.
Well, I think you're seeing me now.
Yeah.
We just met, you know, a little bit ago. So
6 months ago. It just seems like.
You know, I was saying wrong, I bite your head off, but I'd be quick to make a decision, you know?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
No, we shouldn't do that. You know, why are we doing that? Yeah, come on, man, you know, come on. And not really thinking about maybe the other guy's feelings, what he wants, you know, maybe, maybe he's been told this in some of my relationships too, you know, where, you know, hey Dave, you're not thinking about me, you know? So I think that's changed in my life, you know, or I'm still working on that. Master.
Don't say that, because that implies I have my shit together, and that is the furthest thing from the truth.
Well, we're always learning, right?
That's yeah, life. All a work we're in progress, man. Yeah, every hell yeah. Day. Hey, listen, man. Let me just tell people where they could find you. I really appreciate your time. You've been awesome to deal with in every way possible.
Hey, man, Craig, I consider you a good friend, man. And
likewise,
and, we've talked about some good things even off the air. That,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We can't put on the air that no. really. family oriented, you know, and friends, good yeah, friends man. Now.
Yeah,
I would. Right. And I said, call me, you know, call me anytime you want to speak off the air, off the record, and we'll talk, you know. So
100%,
as close as we're good friends, it's just great.
100%, man.
You know, knowing you, man.
Likewise. Hey, let me tell people where to find. First of all, Dave's getting ready to go out and do about 70 or 80 shows with REO Speedwagon. So please check out REO Speedwagon and go out and support Dave and the REO guys. They've been at this a really long time. Dave alone has been with the band 28 years, and they're still selling out arenas and shows and whatever venues they're playing. If you're a lead guitar player and you want to check out a fantastic guitar, check out it's Dave Amato, AMATO's custom signature Gibson Les Paul, single humbucker 57 classic, Floyd Rose, a white ebony fretboard, gorgeous freaking guitar, 7 pounds. He's also got an acoustic Ovation Viper.
Right. That's right. Yeah. In their arsenal over there. Yeah. Ovation made me Ovation Viper, yeah, and I think it's a beauty. I was a little skeptical at first, and they said, we want to make you something cool, and I kind of put my 2 cents in for the design, and they sent it to me from the – they opened up the new factory, well, the old factory in Connecticut again, the old Ovation factory.
They got it back. They're making those here.
Yeah, and the custom shop – it's a custom shop in Connecticut. And they built me one there, 6-string Viper, and they sent it to me, and I was really impressed. I couldn't believe it. I said, you know, look, even if you make one and I didn't like it, I said I'd pay for it, whatever. You know,
yeah,
I
mean, yeah.
I wasn't sure if I wanted to jump on board, but it was so good. I couldn't resist. So they make me the 6-string Viper, and then they made me a double neck as well. So I have a double neck version, a 12-string, 6-string, and a 6-string Viper, which they did a great job on it.
Awesome.
They're really nice people too. So I have that acoustically, and I have my Gibson Les Paul access at Gibson. So I'm a lucky guy.
Awesome. So please check out Dave's guitars, the Ovation Viper, and the custom signature Dave Amato Les Paul access. And that's about it, man. We'll have part two of Dave and Craig Go to Therapy.
But it could be a new show.
It could be
a
new show.
Everybody loves therapy.
Everybody loves therapy. Yes, yeah, so we're going to have Dave Amato headlining that podcast. I got my hands full.
Oh, you're in trouble.
Listen, man, I can't thank you enough for your time. You're awesome. Really glad I got to meet you and connect with you. Everybody check out Dave on the road and check out REO Speedwagon and support the guys. They've been doing what they're doing for a long time. They're great at it. Everyone, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview and had as much fun as I did. Thanks again to Dave Amato for spending all this time with us. I really appreciate it. Go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified about future episodes. Add your name to the mailing list. You'll get some early product announcements and discounts. And most importantly, remember that happiness is a choice. So be nice, choose wisely, go play your guitar and have some fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Everyone Loves Guitar. If you did, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe and subscribe to the audio podcast and to our very active YouTube community. And if you have any comments, please write me at everyonelovesguitar.com/hello. We'll see you on the next episode. Until then, make sure you choose happiness, relax, and have as much fun as possible.